All right, and we're on. This is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today is July 21st, 2019, and I'm with Deborah Page at her home in Elfin Cove. So could we begin just by having you restate your name for me and tell me a little bit about where you were born?
Oh my goodness. I'm Deborah Page, and I was born in New Jersey and have not been back to the East Coast for a long time. I followed a man to Alaska in 1973, and I've been here ever since. And so the Hobbit Hole story starts in 1970. The winter of 74-75, I flew out to Elfin Cove with a friend and saw the Hobbit Hole and heard that it was out there. And at that time, that was the dream of all of our lives, was to live in the bush and to have a place like that. And the next summer, I came fishing with a different boyfriend who still lives in Elfin Cove and is a very good friend still. And then I spent the winter in Elfin Cove. And that must have been 76. It's the dates are a little hard. But I spent the winter in Elfin Cove in the house that my son now owns and lives in, which is pretty fun. And partway through the winter, that was when the hippies versus the rednecks was absolutely horrible. And there were a number of people in Elfin Cove who thought I was white trash and they wanted me out. And it finally got to me, so I got in my kayak and started kayaking across South Pass, because I knew there were a couple guys over at the Hobbit Hole. And I sort of didn't leave for 18, 19 years. I was back and forth that winter from the Hobbit Hole to here and hooked up with one of the two guys. And we were there all the next summer, and I lived there with him the whole next winter. And then that spring was when I bought my first boat. Actually, I borrowed a boat and I bought an engine for it, an outboard. And I dredged up a few old pieces of gear and started fishing. And I can't quite remember. I think I made, I don't know, either $200 or $800 that summer. But it was enough for me to go back to Yosemite and climb. So that was all I cared about. And by the next year, I bought a real boat. And it was still a hand troller, so no power involved in getting the fish up. But I was fishing. And at that point, Fred was fishing at the Hobbit Hole. Greg was running the Packer, the fish buying boat for Juno Cold Storage. And 78, that's when Patrick and Bobbo came on the Man of Erin, a little double ender that they bought in Fairbanks and brought down. And Dennis Montgomery was in the Boston Whaler, and he showed up about that same time. And Captain Snoozy in the P.K. Brazos came that year or the next, I can't remember. And at any rate, the original crew was Greg and Fred, Reba, Van, and Ronald. Those were the five guys. And I joined them, And in the summer, we had a Wendy who kept the gardens and sort of took care of everybody. And we all lived on, we lived on our boats. I often lived in the back room. Many things happened. And, you know, we all shared the cooking. We shared the work. We did, you know, we acted like a commune, although Greg and Fred were sort of supporting all of us. We all chipped in our ways. And the Hobbit Hole sort of grew from there. And then Kim came and lived with Greg and fished for him once he started fishing on the Quest. And he fished the sailboat, which you guys still have. He fished his dad's sailboat for part of a summer in between working, running the scow. And then a variety of other people started showing up, coming in and out. And as we fished more, we got crewmen and they added to the population. I think at one point there were about 40 people living there, and it had stopped being a family. It was, you know, it was sort of a business. And by then, Jane and Jennifer Stromey and Jane, who is married to Greg now, were the paid cooks. And, you know, they actually made money. You know, they made their living by cooking for all these fishermen. So that just was a little too much. But the glory days of the Hobbit Hole, I think, to me, were when we were all very young and, you know, in our 20s. We were all dreamers. We were living the dream of dreams, you know, living in the Alaska bush and being concerned for one another and really caring for one another and, you know, making all of that stuff work. And, you know, I moved in and out. I was climbing, so I'd go to Yosemite in the spring and the fall and, you know, come back for part of the winter and all of the summer. And we all fished. And we all learned to fish by working together. Fred had the only real boat for a long time, the Amaliel, which must have been 38 foot, 36 foot wood boat. But he had a radar. And at one point, all of us little boats, you know, we were mostly skiffs. We were all hand trolling. And we were mostly skiffs with outboard engines. And when the fog would come, we'd make a long line behind Fred, and he'd just lead us along the drag. And, you know, we could fish, even though we didn't have any equipment. I didn't have a depth finder. I didn't have anything. I had no equipment. I just would listen for the surf and, you know, use landmarks or get behind somebody who had electronics. And boy, I think it was like 79 before I had hooked up with Bobo by then, and he put a depth finder on my boat, so I finally had that. I could see the depth. That was the only thing I could see. But we just shared all the knowledge. And there was one boat out there we knew what a good fisherman he was. So we'd try really hard to get close to see what kind of gear he was running. And I remember one morning, you know, I was getting really close and looking up over, and one of my poles ran right into his boat, and I was so embarrassed. Like one of the nicest boats anywhere. And, you know, I ran away. But, you know, somebody would see, oh, he's using a green hoochie. And at home, everybody, they'd say it. And, you know, a green hoochie. We all got to get green hoochies now. It was pretty silly. I mean, it wasn't, you know, we learned. And Greg was so driven that he just made us all do it. You know, he would get up at 3:30, 4, you know. He'd get up later all through the season because daylight's later. And when he got up, that was it. We all had to get going, and we all did. And but nobody ever tied outside of him because that would be really dangerous. And we just worked, and we put in our long day, and then we all came home and made dinner and talked and laughed and played cards and did things together. And that was really great. And, you know, various people had Kim and Ronald did the gardens. And at one point we had an ornamental garden that was just outstanding. And we'd all go to the beach and pick up buckets and buckets and buckets of white stone so that we could make the white stone path. We'd spend, you know, hours and hours doing that. Or, you know, my job was always the strawberry bed, so I would, you know, I didn't know anything about gardens. I didn't know anything about planting or soil or anything. I was a hunter-gatherer, but I knew how to weed. And so I would weed that strawberry bed because I love strawberries. And I kept that going. And then I got pregnant and had Tyga. And he was a blessing and a curse, you know. It was a little hard for all the guys to suddenly have a baby around.
Was that the first baby?
Oh, yeah. He was by far the first baby. And, yeah, so there were some hard points, you know. I was naive enough to really think they all were my brothers and would just accept that he was their child too, but it didn't really work that way. But they were also extraordinarily accepting that, you know, we live there. And they loved the kids. Everybody was wonderful. And the kids just remember it as paradise. You know, they, you know, we had beautiful lawns and dogs and out on the point, they'd go to the tide pools and go fishing for blennies and turn stones over and they'd go hiking. And Tyga was a very adventurous toddler. And when he was about 2, a few times he disappeared. He just would take off into the forest.
At 2.
Yeah. And, you know, it was terrifying. You know, suddenly my son would be gone. And you know, Dick Hoffman was there at that point, and he had a search and rescue dog. And we actually sent the search and rescue dog after him. And every, you know, of course, the big fear was that he had somehow gotten to the dock and gotten in the water. And people were just searching every which direction. And we found him like a quarter mile down this path along the beach out past Swing Cove. But we got him back. And and another story about Tyga. When he was 4 or so, Joe Handtroller, another of the guys, came running down from the sauna or the hot tubs saying, "I found Tyga with a hatchet." And we just looked at him and said, "Yeah, he's chopping some kindling." You know, he grew up on my boat. He had a knife in his hand when he was 2 years old. Might have been a real dull knife. And, you know, I let him poke at herring that came out of fish's bellies. But when he was 4 or 5, he actually pulled his first line of fish, hand-trolled it, hand-pulled it. He knew that I had carpal tunnel in both hands. He knew that I was having a really rough day. And he said, I'll do that, mommy. And by golly, he cranked that thing up. And, you know, they always helped with the fish. That's how they both learned to count, was they'd get a penny for every job. So every fish they'd move from a fish tub into the tank or, you know, anything that they did, so they learned to count. They learned to count really high. And, yeah, so I always had my own boat, and Bobo always had his own boat. Except for the first year when Tygo was born, I did not fish that year. I came out to the Hobbit Hole, and I intended to fish, but I just couldn't. I couldn't pull it together. And then the year Rylan was born, Bobo and I decided that we would fish together on his new boat. That was the biggest disaster of our life. I'm surprised that he's still alive. I'd have that gaff hook in my hand and I'd just be looking at him. I have a bad nature. And it was really close.
Why was it so terrible when both of you were together on that boat?
We're both captains. I do not take well to anyone telling me what to do, ever. And on a boat, somebody telling me what to do? And, you know, we're working really hard. It's hard work. And I remember the worst moment of all that summer. We were fishing humpies, which is just crazy hard work. And Tyga came out of the wheelhouse and said, Rylan's awake, he's crying. And, of course, I was going to get up and feed him and, you know, comfort him and bring him out and put him in the Johnny jump up or something, or put him on my back and go back to work. And Bobo just turned to me and said, keep pulling. And that was the moment when I'm really surprised he did not get a gaff hook through the side of his head. It just looked just like a humpy at that minute. And oh yeah, so we never tried fishing together again. I don't know whether I'm supposed to say things that awful, but it's true. It was bad.
And I can imagine having two young children and pretty much working all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, really hard.
On a really dangerous boat. And there are I'll tell you a couple of stories. These are about Rylan. Because the boys grew up on the boat, and they were on the boat almost every day, every once in a while. I tried to go in early so that they could get some beach time every day. And there were a few times when I could bring them here to a friend. One year I had a nanny, and she stayed in this cabin, and their best friend was in this cabin that Tyga now owns, and she would watch the little kids, so I could go out for a few hours and, you know, and do that occasionally. But otherwise, they were on the boat, and, you know, I had to read to them, and we had to sing songs and tell stories while I'm doing the work and trying to keep them, you know, from not killing one another or falling overboard or getting in, you know, once I had a power troller, you know, the equipment's dangerous, and, you know, that was difficult. Actually, I have four stories about Ryland. So, the worst story. Rylan was a baby. He was still nursing. So he was a baby. He must have been 1 and a half or something. And we were in my double ender, the Man of Erin, two lines, you know, going 20 fathoms deep. And I was in really big current, and I hit bottom with one of the leads. And Ryland had just woken up, and I was nursing him, and he didn't have a life jacket on because the bartender had a forecastle where we all slept, and then it had like a carport roof, and then an open back deck. So the carport roof was open, but I hadn't put a life jacket on because I was just going to nurse him and hope he'd go back to sleep and lay down. But when the lead snagged, you know, the boat has these big arms, right? Mm-hmm. And when the lead snagged, that boat arm pulled over, and my boat hit, the current was pushing it sideways. And the next minute, the gunwale of my boat was in the water. And I had an immediate choice. I could try to get Ryland down, in which case the boat could have flipped, or I could reach, just drop him where he was and reach for the steering. And I decided to reach for the steering, but meanwhile he slid and I barely caught hold of him as he was going overboard. So this was a rather panically, really bad moment. I got him aboard, and of course he's crying at that point, and I just dropped him. I put him on the floor, and I'm fighting the steering and fighting the boat, and getting on the VHF and or the radio and just saying, I'm in trouble, somebody help. And we all listened to the radio. We all were glued to the radio all the time because, we were all beginners and we always got in trouble. Everybody got in trouble. We were always calling for help. And Patrick came over in his, he sped over in his boat. I was so frantically turning and twisting my boat, trying to get a line so the current couldn't push me over, that he couldn't get any closer. I was hoping he could get close enough to clip the line off, just cut it, but he couldn't. And things just went on and on. Finally the pole broke, just whammo, and that relieved the pressure. So that was a really bad moment, and I went in that night, and Bobo came in, and we were actually going to have our August closure in a couple of days, and he said, "You're going to town." So I got Ryland, and we got on a plane and went into town like that evening because I was really flipped out. And Paula, Dick Hoffman's wife, met me at the airport. And we were driving down the Eagan Expressway, and Ryland managed to open the car door. No car seat, of course, but he managed to open the car door. So you can get in trouble doing anything, but that was like a really, really bad day. That was a really dangerous one. Another story about Ryland. I think he was, 7 or 8, and we were in the Madam Ching by then. And Tyga was my crewman. Tyga's 4 years older. So, yeah, he was probably 12 and crewing for me. And it was a heavy fog. And I told Ryland that he had to drive the boat with the radar. And he was saying, "I can't do that." I said, "No. You're going to pretend it's a video game and you're going to drive the boat because you can see the radar and the electronics. I can't. I'm in the back." And we were really catching fish, so we were working really hard. And by golly, that little boy, he just got in there and he drove that boat for us. He probably only lasted for an hour or so, but, it was probably the tide change and we were really catching fish. And and he did it. And then when he was 9, I remember very clearly, we were at Dundas Bay. And of course I'm diverging from the Hobbit Hole to fishing, but the Hobbit Hole was all about fishing. So and about, you know, everybody helping one another. Anyway, we were at Dundas Bay and got into an incredibly hot bite. And he was 9 years old, and this is power gear. And he just, he got on one side and he pulled up those fish. And it was fall, so they were, you know, they were 7-8 pound, all of them 7-8 pound fish. And I'd run over there and conk it in the head and run back and run my side. And he'd pull it in, and then he'd pull the next one. I'd run over and conk it and run back and run my gear. And he did that for, you know, probably 2 hours. He just worked, you know, he did a man's job. No doubt he did a man's job. And, you know, we got it. We got her done and did really well. So, you know, the boys did grow up on the boat, and they both learned to work really, really hard. And they're two of the best fishermen in the fleet now. And Ryland has Greg's old boat, the Kita, which is one of the best fishing boats out there. And pretty much anyone would agree that they're two of the, you know, mm-hmm. they're both great fishermen, and they both really know how to work. So those are, I don't know, fishing stories with my kids. A lot of people remember Taiga when he was little and I was still in the skiff. And, you know, we'd just be out there and he'd just be doing stuff, you know. You know, you can see the kids, that little towhead out there on the boat. But yeah, besides learning to fish together, you know, having that safety net was just a big part of it. I think in a 1 week period, I saved Jimmy saved Patrick saved, you know, or an engine stopped or, you know, something happened. And, you know, you just go and you move as fast as you can to get in there and throw them a line and pull them out of danger. But it was just funny that 1 week, you know, each of us had a chance to help one of the other ones. And, you know, the knowledge was really important besides learning the hard work together.
Do you think you would have stayed in Alaska if it hadn't been for the Hobbit Hole?
Yeah. I would have done something, but because this was the whole life that I've always wanted and still is. I mean, obviously, this is 40. I've been fishing since 75. So this is 44 years. I'm still doing the same thing. And my kids are too. And yeah, I couldn't imagine living somewhere else. And yeah, I don't live at the Hobbit Hole anymore, but it's a very similar life, you know. We're in Elfin Cove, but a little bit separated from it, and we have gardens. And because it's, you know, the families, you know, both my sons are here, both my daughters-in-law. And Baba and I, and Taiga and Amy and the kids live right next to us. You know, we still have this communal thing going, and it's still the same thing, you know. Just last week, Ryland's crewman got sick from the smoke. And, you know, the first thing Ryland did was called his dad and said, get the speedboat, you need to come and get Brandon, he's sick. And, you know, a couple days before that, Taiga had an engine problem, and Ryland was right there, you know, drug him for about 4 hours while he worked on the engine. And, you know, we all really watch each other. When Holly first got her new engine put in the boat, which Ryland helped her with and Bobo helped her with, the engine had a flaw in it. And it broke down on the fourth day of Kings. Mm. And Bobo immediately jumped on the boat and then gave her his boat so she could get back out fishing while she was waiting for parts to come. You know, so it's the same. it's the same communal thing that we all learned at the Hobbit Hole. You know, my kids are such good fishermen, not because we taught them to fish, but because they learned from all those guys. they just were little sponges. And everybody thought, oh, they're just kids, you know. And pretty soon, you know, they took over the world.
So how old were you when you first came to Alaska?
20.
20.
Yeah. And yeah, I must have been 22 when I came out here. The year that I lived here, 22, 23, something, when I showed up at the Hobbit Hall. The boys are all 2 years older than I am, all the Hobbits, because they all knew each other from college. And I keep throwing out different names as different people show up at the Hobbit Hall.
Do you mind if I ask you some questions about your life before Alaska?
Sure.
Was anyone in your family ever involved in fishing?
No.
No. So no. How did that happen for you?
After high school, I was supposed to go to Vassar. But I decided to put out my thumb and hitchhike west. I had met a guy that winter, and he had moved to Colorado Springs, and I thought I'd go visit. So I hitchhiked across country and fell for some guy. I fell for a lot of guys in my day. Fell for some guy in Colorado Springs, and I ended up staying there. So got in a lot of trouble from my parents for that one. And I went to University of Colorado for a year and a couple months and met another guy, and that was the guy that I followed to Alaska. And so that was the progression from the East Coast to here.
And as a kid, were you always sort of seeking out adventures?
Yes.
Yeah.
My brother's 8 years older than I am, and he was absolutely wonderful. And he would take me into the woods. My parents are very, very different than that. My dad would look at the woods and just go, ooh. You know, they like golf and tennis. And, you know, I grew up in the suburbs. It was a wonderful life. But I always, you know, I just dreamed of wilderness from day one. I just wanted to, I resented every time they tried to put a dress on me, which they tried a lot. My poor cousins. My mom was absolutely beautiful woman. She looked a lot like Ingrid Bergman. She was just beautiful, and she had a real sense of taste. And you know, we didn't have my dad started a newspaper, became a publisher. But in the beginning, we didn't have a lot of money, but my mom knew how to be very stylish. I went to a family reunion a few years ago, and one of my much older cousins was a teenager when my parents were newly married. And he said that he and his friends, that was like the thing that the teenagers would do. They'd go to my parents' house so they could look at my mom. She was very stylish, and she loved, you know, she was so happy she had a girl after 8 years with a boy, and she wanted to dress me up. And all of my cousins at this reunion were saying, "We just hated you. You had all of those nice things and you wouldn't wear them. We watched you just take them off and throw them in the mud and run around in your underwear." Oh, well, we would have died to have had those things. Anyway. Yes, I was always adventurous.
Were you close with your parents?
Yeah. They really hated my lifestyle. They, you know, they wanted me to go to a good college so I could marry some, you know, rich guy and live in New York City and have the good life. And, you know, my idea of the good life was just really different. So, yeah.
So it's something that you've always had in you. You wouldn't say there's a specific moment or experience that made you want to sort of live this life in the wilderness. And
Mm-mm. No, I mean, it took me a while to find it. Mm-hmm. You know, growing up in New Jersey, there's not a lot, you know, there are woods, and I spent all the time that I could in the woods and learned as much as I could, you know, how to do those things, and played with the guys a lot because they tended to do funner things. I kept trying to do, you know, I did sports. I was always athletic and, yeah, went to Colorado and then to Alaska. And yeah, this is my perfect place.
And then when did climbing come into your life?
When I was living in Juneau, I was probably 75. As the spring before I moved out here, John Svensson, a very famous climber in Alaska, was taking people up on the Mendenhall Glacier, you know, guiding them up there. And my best friend went up with him, and I'd been out doing some wild thing and came back, and she said, I just did this thing, you've got to come with us. So I ended up going up on the glacier, and I stayed there for a month or so. I just, you know, I didn't want to come down. So I just camped up on the glacier and learned to climb. And then John took me to Yosemite that fall, the fall that I lived here in Elfin Cove, whichever year that was. And that was the same fall winter that I ended up at the Hobbit Hole. And then I'd go back to Yosemite every spring and every fall for, you know, a month or 6 weeks and climb. And I did some I climbed around Juneau. I did climbing around here. I took one of our Wendy's, Robin Rogers, up Dundas Bay and put a rope around her and drug her up the mountain into the granite domes up on top of Dundas Bay, looking down into Glacier Bay. It was really spectacular. And I've been trying to go back now for 40 years, and I keep thinking maybe my husband will come with me this year.
Someone told me that you were the youngest woman to climb El Capitan.
No. Tyga was the youngest person ever to climb
up. Tyga?
Yeah, he was 4 months old in my belly. He was 4 months in my belly when I climbed the Shield. And I was the first woman to climb the Shield, for whatever that's worth. You know, one of the big walls in Yosemite.
And you climbed it while pregnant.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't tell my partner. He just thought I was a little fat. I told him afterward. He just shook his head. Because I took a 40-foot fall when I was up there.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, you were in a harness. It just swung a bunch. I don't think that it hurt. But anyway, yeah.
What do you think it is about climbing that you just so attracted you to it?
It's meditation. You know, it's the strictest form of meditation. You lose your concentration and you die. It's pretty straightforward. Well, Alex Hunnell will die. I was tied to a rope, but but yeah, it was just, you know, it's absolutely physical. It was, you know, there were just such great people there. Our house in Idaho were there because of the friends that I met in Yosemite. They all moved to Driggs, Idaho, near Jackson Hole. And so Bobo and I would always visit them, and we ended up moving there for the winters because the skiing's so good. And they're still some of my best friends. I've known them longer than I've known Bobo. So, you know, combination of wonderful people, exercise, outdoors, sun on rock. There's nothing better. That manzanita smell. Oh, yeah.
And then I was wondering.
Bloody hands. Oh, man.
When's the last time you went climbing?
Before I knew I was pregnant with Ryland, I was back in Yosemite. That was going to be, you know, going back to Yosemite. Then I found out I was pregnant. So I did some climbing then. And then when the kids were growing up, we would go to Joshua Tree and took them both climbing. They were little climbing monsters. But I haven't done serious climbing since I was pregnant with Ryland. Oh, well, I climbed Foraker when Tyga was 2 years old. So
you're living at the Hobbit Hole during the summers, and then what did you do during the winters?
Yosemite and Yosemite, Hobbit Hole. I worked in Juneau part-time, hung out, skied, traveled. I did those things. And then Babo had a house in Fairbanks. So when Babo and I hooked up, we would go back to Fairbanks for the winter. Although we always traveled every winter, because we're fishermen, we don't have to work otherwise. And well, the first couple of years, he worked and I took care of the baby. But then once I was working harder fishing, we could afford not to work in the winter. And we would travel. And we did that all through the kids' school. We'd take off for a month and a half to 3 months and travel the world.
Wow.
So the kids pretty much went everywhere. Ryland didn't go to Antarctica, and I feel bad about that. He and Bobble were going to go to Antarctica. I had no interest in getting on a boat and doing a long boat. I do enough boats. But they were going to do it, and I can't remember why they didn't. But, yeah, Africa and Asia and Europe and South America, Central America. We did a lot of travel.
Any favorite places?
Namibia. I love Namibia.
Why?
I guess because I've always loved big cats. And there were just cheetahs everywhere and sand dunes. And it was completely isolated. Hardly anybody there. Mm. We had rented a car and we just car camped for weeks. And we ended up going to Satatosha. We ended up going to one of the big game parks there and camped there for a while. And yeah, I just thought it was a phenomenal place. So supply, sand dunes of all, you know, red sand dunes and white sand dunes and black sand dunes. Climb them and then ski down them, mm-hmm. run down them. Ah, yeah.
So you and Babu have been together for how many years now?
We got married at the beginning of 81. So we hooked up around 79.
Mm.
We met in 78. And I decided that he was the one, and I pursued him until he finally relented.
Oh, you were the one who pursued him.
Oh, you bet.
What made you decide that he was the one you're going to stick with?
I was on a winter ski trip with a girlfriend. And we were up, where were we? By Mount Huntington. We were just, you know, we did a week-long ski in and out. By Mount Deborah is where we were. And one night we were sitting in the tent. And she said, okay, of all the guys you've ever met, who's the one that, you know, you'd want to marry? And I'd never even thought about Bobo that way. And I just said Bob Bell. And I sort of stuck by it. I went out and pursued him. And after a while, I think the moment that, in many ways, the moment that I finally won his heart, I went up to Fairbanks in February and said, let's go into the Ruth Amphitheater. And we ended up doing a 10-day ski trip into the amphitheater. And we had many pretty big adventures. He got frostbite. We got in a major snowstorm with avalanches. We ended up going down this horrendous thing, you know, real mountaineering. And so at one point, a Bergschrund at the, we were going down this thing near Moose's Tooth, you know, just remarkably steep. And, you know, we were going by rope. We're working our way down, laying each other down, and a snowstorm came in, and up above us there were these, you know, just enormous cornices that were, you know, we could see falling any moment, and we started hearing the avalanches, and it became total whiteout. And so it was like seriously dangerous, and came to a Bergschrund. And so we had a sled with us, and we dropped the sled, and the sled went out of sight, which was a bad thing. And so I was belaying Bobo down to see if he could find a way across the Bergschrund and see what had happened to our sled. And he said that he loved me. That was the moment. First time. And I had already declared myself. I told him that I wanted to have his babies. So it was a pretty important time. There wasn't any other girl who was going to do that for him, you know? So anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking with it.
It sounds like you've had a lot of near death, sort of dangerous experiences.
Yeah. Actually, my first time going to the heading to the Hobbit Hole when I was living here, I misread the tide book. And I was in my kayak. It was the middle of winter. And I got into South Pass thinking that it was going to be flooding, and it was ebbing. And the ebb grabbed me and pulled me out into the tide rips. And it was like a really scary time. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time in a kayak, and I managed to get, I fought my way out of it. It was a battle to work my way out of it. Cause I was stupid. I misreading the tide book and then not seeing it in time so that I actually was caught by the tide and pulled out. But I came back into Elfin Cove, and I didn't see anybody on the way in. You know, it's winter. Everybody's holed up in there. And it was, you know, duskish. And I got back into the cabin, and for a while, I was wondering whether I had died, because there was nothing, there was no way for me to tell whether, you know, I was in a death state or a life state. I was there. it was just an interesting moment, because it was very intense. Really. Whew. Yeah. And then next time I was a little more cautious with the tide, and I went during the flood and made it.
So that was one of your first times going to the Hobbit Hole?
That was the first time.
Oh. Yeah. Do you remember what you were thinking when you first saw the Hobbit Hole?
I cried. It was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. It was the most perfect place I'd ever seen. And actually, I had been in there. My boyfriend Jim and I went in there in his boat and visited. Picked berries, made a blueberry pie for them the summer before. And, you know, so I had met them. Because Jim was also in that same class.
Mm.
They were in high school. Some of them were in high school. Greg and Jim were in high school together. And the other Hobbits, some of them were in high school too, but a bunch of them they met at college. So.
After you and Jim weren't together, did he stay at the Hobbit Hole?
He never stayed at the Hobbit Hole. He was always here, and he hooked up with Mary Jo, who lives right there. That's his house.
I see.
Yeah. And she was my very close friend. We all talked about it. It was fine.
What was Elfin Cove like in those days?
There was a strong redneck population. I really was called white trash.
Why?
Because I was a hippie, you know. And, I'm an educated hippie. And hardworking. And, yeah. But, you know, they had their way of life. They were actually families here. You know, there was a school. And a bunch of families lived here. And, you know, they resented us young people moving in. And it wasn't just me, you know. Mary Jo was one of the first of the hippies to move in. She was not popular.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that first winter I came here, you know, the battle lines were sort of laid out between the hippies and the straight people. And, you know, those things have gone by the wayside. I don't know, probably 10 or 15 years ago now, I was making a quilt, a friendship quilt, for Augusta, who was the matriarch of Elfin Cove. Through all that period, Roy, the greenhouse there, Roy, Uncle Roy, everybody called him Uncle Roy. He took care of everybody. He was wonderful. And his wife Augusta took care of everybody and took care of all the kids. And so I decided to make a friendship quilt for them. So I was calling up people to contribute. And I ended up calling up one of the women who had lived in Elfin Cove during the time, who hated me the most. Mm. And it was the weirdest feeling. Because she was really just incredibly unpleasant to me, mean. And
still.
No, then. And then, you know, I talked to her on the phone, and it's like, oh, we were suddenly grown-ups, you know, doing something nice together. It was like just so weird. And I'm so glad that it happened, you know?
But that must have been hard for you at that time, right? You were here pretty much on your own. And
that winter, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. The guys all liked me. I played with the guys.
Yeah, was that ever uncomfortable for you to be one of the few women around?
The guys were always really great, really helpful, really encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were still, gender roles were still pretty established at that point. You know, I did a lot of the cooking at the Hobbit Hole. Did a lot of everything at the Hobbit Hole, but, you know, I would often be cooking when the guys were chopping wood or something, mm-hmm. but then I'd go out and chop wood and haul wood. You know, so we all did all the things, but Kim and I did a lot of the the gender things. And I wasn't expected to work as hard as Babo, but I couldn't have because I had the kids. You know, I definitely did the kid care, mm-hmm. you know, and everyone, you know, if the kids were misbehaving, they never said, Babo, you know, get Tyga. It was always, Deborah. Deborah. I have some resentment about that, I have to say. But it was also natural at that time, you know, before things changed as much as they have now.
And do you think being a lady fisherman, do you think that gives you any advantages or disadvantages?
Yeah, it was... crewmen on boats get their status from their captain, you know, so that the crew that works for the best boats, they have the highest status of all the crews. And, you know, that's important to people. But since I didn't have a defined status, even though I turned into a pretty good fisherman, I was never as good as Babo or Greg. But I could, you know, I was as good as anybody else in the fleet. But, you know, I couldn't get good crewmen very often. I couldn't get experienced crewmen. You know, Greg could have anybody. Babo could have anybody. And they'd want to come back year after year. And, you know, so that was a weird part of it. And I had one crewman who refused to do anything I said. I'd actually have to have my 9-year-old Tyga go and tell him to pull the port line or something. You know, I'd say, you know, you have to clip him on this way. And he just, why? You know, that was very frustrating. That was a really bad crewman. I finally traded him for somebody else. The guys all loved him. He was, you know, real. He was a fun guy, but he was not terrible to me, for me. Sometimes he'd listen to Tyga. Mm-hmm. Usually Babo would have to yell at him at the end of the day. It was really what a scene. Yeah. And then everybody still doesn't know what to call me, you know, a fisherwoman or fisherperson. It's like, you know, I do the same job as all the other fishermen. Why don't you just call me what you call them? You're not going to call Babo a fisherperson, you know.
Were there other women fishing at the Hobbit Hole?
Not at the Hobbit Hole. Sandy, who lived here, had a skiff. For a few years, and then she became a charter. Colleen from Gustavus had a skiff for a couple years. There was a gal at Soapstone for a couple years, and Linda Danner, who's now at Sitka and other places. She's always been fishing. She was always around. And then one of the best fishermen in the fleet is Bonnie Millard. But she was still fishing with her husband back in the day. so, yeah, there were a few women. Jeez. Yeah. Yeah, very, you know, it was one of those golden times. I talked about the smell of rock and sun and manzanita and the chalk on her hands and the blood, you know, just had this wonderful smell that I'll get whiffs of it every once in a while. It just wants to bring me to my knees. It's so lovely. And, you know, that golden feeling at the Hobbit. I look at that picture of Tyga with the cauliflower. You know, those days on the porch, you know, in the sun, all sitting around and just being together and that was just an amazing special time. Watching those kids, you know, roll around on the grass and and play, you know. And they were the first two. Yeah, Rylan's older than Annie. And then Annie and Katie Stromey. And then the Annie's sisters, the twins, and Eric came later. So Tyga was the head of the pack. We let him take the babies out in the skiff. What were we thinking? What were we thinking, giving him a hatchet, you know? Just, I don't know.
Seems like nothing bad happened, though.
Yeah. No, somehow he'd come home and bring them with him. You know, we always let them gallivant. He'd lead them on hikes and managed to get them back. So, you know, there was a... And then when we moved to Elfin Cove, it was the same thing. You know, he was the oldest, not by much, but he was the leader of the pack of all the kids here. Mm. And they had a bunch of kids. There were a bunch of kids in that cohort, in that posse.
Yeah, what an incredible childhood to have. How many kids get to say they live like that?
Yeah. Yeah, like real freedom. You know, real freedom. Ryland and Tyga and Cal, who would go out and live off the land. They'd take the skiff over to George Island and just... Ryland was smart. He'd always bring some Ritz crackers and something, you know. And the other boys would be prying up barnacles and limpets, and Tyga would grab hold of an octopus and have a fight with an octopus, which was big as he was, pulling him into the water. Oh, yeah.
So how long do the... when did those sort of commune days at the Hobbit Hole end?
You know, I'm not sure of the dates. You're going to have to get the dates from Greg and Jane. We finally decided to have to hire someone to be the cook, because that was like, that was, you know, we'd get home, we were tired, we just wanted something to be done. So I think Lynn might have been the first real cook. And then she was living with Fred at the time. And then Stromey showed up and Jennifer became our cook. And then Greg and Jane was Peggy, who's married to Dennis's best friend. We're gonna make a big map for you. And Jane showed up and married Greg. And she and Jennifer were the cooks for a couple of years. And then Jane finally said, you know, this just isn't working for me anymore. And at that point, you know, my kids were young teenagers. I don't even know the dates. But they were ready to be over here with the other kids their age, mm-hmm. where they could. And they were also working, you know. But I was cracking the whip, making them work on the boat. Because I hated having crewmen. And I could handle having them on the boat. So, it all worked out. And Hap had moved from the Hobbit Hole. Have you contacted Hap?
No, I haven't. Where is he now?
He's down in Port Townsend where he lives, but I'll give you his. You could at least do a phone conversation, because who knows when he's going to get here. Hopefully before you leave. He had already bought this place, and, you know, Bobo and I lived on our boats because it was just, you know, we were set up at that point. So it worked out very well when it was over for Jane, for us to move out. And we, you know, we were still, I mean, we still are really close to Greg and Jane. You know, we we spend time with him in Gustavus now. And yeah.
And you're saying that they would still have Friday potlucks, even though they stopped having dinner every night, right?
Maybe not every Friday, but there, yeah, we were mm-hmm. there a lot in the springtime, particularly. We'd spend, you know, time there with them, and it was just then it was pretty much just us and them, which was great.
And are you still in touch with most of the original Hobbits?
Yeah, yeah, we're all still friends. Oh. Van was the first one to. He worked for Fred for a couple of years, and then he moved to Juneau and did his thing. Ronald was the heart and soul of the Hobbit Hole. Did you ever get hold of him?
Yeah, I'm going to go to Juneau
good.
At the end of my stay here, and he'll be my last interview.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might be able to talk to Van, too. He's in Juneau. Mm. That way you could get the original, well, you can't get the original five, Reba died. But, yeah. Yeah, Ronald was always just magical. Creative, artistic. He just sang and worked and, you know, just kept everything lovely. He is an absolutely wonderful man, and he's married to Dennis's sister.
Oh wow!
See, we are still very.
Yeah.
We're all still very connected.
It sounds like you had a great diversity of sort of personalities and talents at the Hobbit Hole. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I've gotta. You know. Yeah. Yeah, we'd occasionally have meetings, you know. And of course, one of the continual problems was, you know, you got to help. You got to do more. You got to clean up. And somebody would always say, now, Fred doesn't do that much, but he always takes out the trash. Always. You can always depend on him to take out the trash. I don't know whether you want to write that down, but... And, you know, then everybody would pick it up and do a little more. But, yeah. And in the same way that Jane finally broke the Hobbit Hole up, I think that it was hard for Kim, you know, having us all there.
For Kim?
Yeah. Mm. Living with Greg and sort of... being entwined with all of us and the pressures of, you know, commune is all about a lot of pressure. You know, who's doing enough and who's not doing enough, and how do you deal with that? And then hangers-on come, and ex-crewmen show up and they want to live there. And mm-hmm. Things get out of hand. And people don't chip in financially, so Greg supported all of us, I think. I think that I was absolutely clueless, you know, how much he took care of us.
Do you think that was just him being...
It's just who he is.
Yeah.
You know, he was always absolutely generous, and he was the big kahuna. You know, he did you hear that from Tyga? The big kahuna?
No.
Yeah, so we always called him. You know, he was the king. He presided over everything. And you know, he was absolutely generous. He's the godfather of my kids.
Oh really?
Yeah. And I was reading a bunch of journal entries from way back. You know, I'd be at Yosemite, and you know, just the numbers of letters that I wrote back to the Hobbit Hole to Greg. And, you know, he was just my other brother for a long time. And I added a lot of, you know, having kids, I added a lot of attention to the Hobbit Hole. There's no doubt about that. Mm. It's hard. It's hard on a bunch of guys used to being guys to have some little thing going, So, I don't know. Yeah, Greg will tell you all about the origins of the Hobbit Hole. And, I mean, that's the other thing. You know, the work that everybody did, you know, building the water line, digging up the foundation, building the, you know, doing the foundation of the house, my God. Captain Snoozy and Bobbo and Dennis underneath, laying in the mud, you know. And
how do they find time to do that?
We know how to work, you know. Or we, you know, I guess we did a lot of stuff in the fall. We all stayed there, you know, past fishing. I don't think that I went to Yosemite until mid-October often. And, you know, we were there in the spring until fishing really got going, which wasn't till mid-June. And, you know, we would take early days so that we could do chores. Or, you know, it's late until light until late, so, you know, maybe I was weeding 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Who knows? But, yeah. I don't know. Hopefully you'll come up with some questions, figure out some things for all of us to round out in this storytelling. I mean, 4th of July, Easter was always a big holiday here.
Oh, I've heard about 4th of July, but I haven't heard much about Easter.
Yeah, Kim would do a whole bunch of Easter parties, you know. There'd be Easter egg hunts. The kids from Elfin Cove would go over, and they'd play games and stuff. And 4th of July, we must have taken off or just fished early or something, and, you know, we'd have volleyball and, you know, sack race, all kinds of games, and people would come over and we'd have a big potluck. And sometimes we'd come over to Elfin Cove and we'd have Elfin Cove versus Hobbit Hole volleyball game or whatever. But we'd often have a really big party for everybody. I mean, this was all before lodges. When Dennis Hay came over to the Hobbit Hole and said, "I'm thinking of having a lodge," we laughed at him. Oh my God, that was the funniest thing. Who would ever want to come fishing? God. Yeah, a lot of people want to come fishing.
And I heard talent shows are also a thing, right?
Oh yeah, we had talent shows. Yeah, there are a lot of pictures in the albums of different talents.
Did you ever participate in them?
I was not a big participant. Bobbo, of course, is very talented. He participated.
I'll have to ask him.
In many. Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, there'd be music and there'd be weddings. There were many things.
Oh, weddings. Paul Barnes, right? Got married at the Hobbit Hole.
I'm not sure. I might not have been there for that one. People own the brewery in Juneau, the Alaska brewery.
Wow.
We're all original shareholders. Greg and Jane and Bobbo and I. Maybe it's Greg and Kim. I can't remember. Maybe Greg and Kim and Bobbo and I and And Greg's parents were all original shareholders. We all bought one share together.
And you still have it?
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'd have berry picking expeditions and kelp gathering expeditions and lots of wood. Wood was a big thing. Mm. You know, you've been at the Hobbit Hole enough to know how important the wood stove is. And that was an ongoing project for everybody to fill the woodshed. And we always got that done. Yeah.
Do you want to take a break? And are you okay continuing on for a little more?
You know, I should probably, I need to go to work, mm-hmm. but do you have any questions?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, so I was wondering what your thoughts were on when Zach came along and had this vision of turning the Hobbit Hole into a school. And
I think it's the best thing that could happen. You know, I would have loved for Greg and Jane to get their $2 million and have some nice, rich person live there. With a caretaker taking care of it all the time, whom we really liked. But I think that it's an inspired deal. And I'm really, really glad that Zach made it happen. And I just wish that we could include Elfin Cove more in it.
Mm. What do you think that would look like?
I would love for some of your group to come over and do some lectures here. Mm. You know, we need entertainment. I mean, Tanaku Lodge has offered to... I mean, they're a 4-star hotel, you know. Good food, good wine, they'll... And Dennis has said, yeah, have somebody come over and do a lecture for us. My clients would love that. You know, I'd be willing to do it here. You know, people have said, yeah, let's do it in the gym. We'll set up the gym so that everybody can. We're starved for entertainment.
Hmm.
And it'd be really good for some of these people to hear something about the environment or good living or sustainability. Because most of them don't believe any of it, you know.
Mm.
I'd say half the people in town don't believe in climate change, despite being on the water and seeing how things have changed. Kind of crazy.
And you're still fishing now?
I'm still fishing, yeah.
Commercially?
Yeah. Just not very much. Yeah, we're half retired. But I am waiting for him to get my boat fixed so that I can go back out. So, you have any other questions? Because otherwise I really do have to go to work.
No, I mean, unless you have anything else you want to add.
No, but... I'm afraid that I talked a lot more than I expected to.
Oh, no. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.